afternoon. Good afternoon. I'd like to call to order the Conference Committee for Senate File 1384, House File 1522. It is May 18th, 2023. We're in room G3 of the Capitol, and it is 3:40 in the afternoon. A quorum is present, and we're ready to go. I want to welcome everybody to this hearing of this conference committee that has the responsibility of taking up the Keeping the Nurses at the Bedside Act, which is the work product of many, many years of effort, and of course in this session months and months and months of negotiation to bring us to this point. You will have at your desk the latest version of this legislation, which is the A21 amendment, which in a moment Senator Feist is going to move so that we have it before us. I know that there are a number of people here who are prepared and want to testify on this legislation, and we're going to make sure that there is time for that, that there is time for questions before we move this proposal out of this committee. And it is our intention to move this proposal out of the committee and to the respective bodies for floor action before the end of the session. So are there any questions about that to begin with? Senator Abler.
Well, Madam Chair, yeah, thanks for inviting me to join the conference. I appreciate that, and we have a little press thing out there, which I thought was thoughtful and productive. So I've not had the privilege of reading the delete all yet. It looks like it's about an hour old, so it's kind of a newborn. Are we going to look at it and chat and then come back tomorrow and work on this a little bit, which is what I hope the answer is yes?
So, Senator Abler, we're going to go through the bill, and my chair, my co-chair here, Senator Feist, is going to walk us through. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm telling you. Representative Feist. So we'll go through the proposal. We'll take a look at it, and we'll see where we go from there. It is very much, I will say it is a streamlined version of what we have already seen. So there aren't a lot of new additional items. Instead, it is subtractions that you're going to find in the proposal. You're going to see that it is narrowed down, streamlined, and I think highly functional at this point. So what I'd like to do is proceed through that work, take the testimony, and then we can decide if we need to recess for a little while and come back so people have time to think about it. But I also know, and you know, of course, that we are moving through these last days of session, and we want to make sure we get this back up to the floors of the House and the Senate to pass, with due respect and respect for everybody's ability to look at the proposal.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Abler.
So I just will suggest to you that the more time we spend here, at least, and I just would think even overnight, it would probably have less discussion on the floor if we spend this little more time here and getting people on the page. I don't know what the compromises are. I've been part of no discussions, and I'm here to be a productive part of your group, not to slow it down, but also just to help us thoughtfully get a really good product across the line. It won't need to be changed a lot after you do it. So thank you. I'm happy to listen to the testimony. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Abler. Are there other questions before we begin? All right. Perhaps the first piece of work we should do is to put the A21 before us. So
There we go.
Representative Feist.
I would like to move the A1 amendment before the committee.
A21. So, Senator, excuse me, I'm telling you. Representative Feist moves the A21 amendment. In the Senate, we have a tradition of just taking these up and approving them so that we have the piece of work before us. So if there are no questions, Representative Feist moves the A21 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
And those opposed, say no. And that motion is adopted. We have the A21 before us. Senator Feist? No, I did. I really did. I will say Chair Feist. I served in the House for such a long time that it is amazing to me that I have now completely adopted the other title. Chair Feist, would you like to walk us through the detail of this proposal?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I would love to. And I will note for the conferees, you do have a list of 28 compromises that were made from the beginning of the session to date. And I don't have that in front of me, but it's in my brain. But you on the conference committee can refer to that document just as we go, and I'll point out some changes that we've made along the way. I am not going to do this quite as well as nonpartisan staff would, but I'll walk through the bill. So the first section of this bill is the loan forgiveness section. This is an uncontroversial section of the bill, providing some loan forgiveness to incentivize nurses to join the profession. And that section goes up until page 5. On page 5, we have the violence against healthcare workers, violence in the workplace section of this bill. This provision is equally uncontroversial. And what it does is it just creates some structure for hospitals and their staff to develop an action plan collaboratively to address violence in the workplace. That's something that has become increasingly problematic in hospitals. It's something that we seek to address through this bill through the next section, which is the staffing section. But we also have this portion of the bill that just exclusively works with reducing violence in hospitals. That section goes up until page 13. And on page 13, we get to the heart of this bill, which is the staffing section.
Madam Chair.
Senator Abler.
It would be helpful to me, who have been part of no conversations of any substance on this topic, if you could point out where you think there's generally agreement. It seems like, as I look at this so far, it seems like nobody really minds the forgiveness part. It seems like the violence thing seems kind of straightforward. There's probably some details to it. But if you could just point out where the flashpoints have been, so then we can focus on those. There's probably only three or four things for us really to be talking about. My question is the violence thing, but just I'll back up. So this draft is an hour old, and it's been available to the public. Do they know it was available to be seen, like everybody who cares about this? Or do they get it when they walk in the door? Do you know that?
Senator Abler, this draft is posted online and was posted when right after we noticed the meeting.
Right.
And so it is publicly available.
So many of the people that have concerns wouldn't know. It's timestamp 233. So I'm just aware of that. So maybe some people's concerns are happy to see this good news. So anyway, just if you could, and I don't mean to be talking too much, but I'm sincerely interested in helping you get a product that we're all going to like that actually keeps patients safe and nurses.
And Senator Abler, I will, Chair Feist can.
Yeah, so she's going through.
She can touch on this a little bit more.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
But I will say that those who have been most concerned about this proposal, those entities who have had opposition to, have been very involved in this work product, even though they don't necessarily support it. Much of what they've had to say, especially the Hospital Association, much of their work is reflected here. And as I said, Chair Feist can enumerate on that, but there you go.
Thank you. So on the workplace violence, I'll just mention that NAMI Minnesota provided some helpful input around some of the elements here. So we appreciated that input. So again, that part of this bill is not controversial, but in terms of updates that we've made, we have incorporated some input from NAMI. As I go through, I'm absolutely happy to show some of the changes that we've made to address some concerns and any kind of remaining issues. That some folks might have. Bottom of page 13, we start heading into the staffing committee section. The purpose of the section is to create a structure where nurses have a voice in staffing, and that is the goal here. But I will note that hospitals, almost universally, if not universally, we have a couple of nurses on this committee, they can confirm, have committees that do this, that operate in this way. And so this is not a totally new concept for hospitals. So what this section will do, it creates the Concern for Safe Staffing Form, which exists in M&A hospitals. But the Department of Health will create this form, and in collaboration with the Hospital Association, we made sure that there was some specific instruction to the Department of Health, which comes up later in this bill, just to make sure that that form isn't confusing, that it achieves its purpose, and that it doesn't undermine similar forms or parallel forms that hospitals have that achieve other goals. So that's something I'll point out on the definitions page. Applicability, so on to page 15, it does not apply in this case to Mayo. And that is what that section says. Moving on, the Hospital Nurse Staffing Committee. So each hospital will have these staffing committees. The membership will be 50% management, 35% registered nurses, and 15% other bedside staff. Moving on to page 16, things on this page. So the duties of the staffing committee have been combined with another committee. So at the beginning of this session, we had a two-committee structure. There would be what are called workload committees, which we originally had per unit. We had changed that to per patient population. So for example, if a hospital has three med-surg units, they don't need to have three workload committees. But we further streamlined it, so there's just one committee. It's called the staffing committee, and it does multiple things. One of the important things it does is it's going to set the core staffing plan for the year. And that's something that every hospital does, but this would be a more collaborative process. And I will note that I've talked with hospitals, CEOs, chief nurse officers that have a very similar structure already where nurses have a meaningful voice. So again, this is not a totally new concept, but we would have all hospitals in Minnesota, except for Mayo, would have these important committees where nurses would have a voice. And they would also process the concern for safe staffing forms that have not been resolved. So when a nurse on a unit submits a form that they're concerned about safe staffing, there would be a normal process where they would express their concerns and those concerns would be addressed. But if they haven't been able to address those concerns, that would go to the staffing committee. And this was a huge, huge compromise because originally the way this bill was structured is that those concern for safe staffing forms individually would be resolved through an arbitration process. In discussions with the Minnesota Hospital Association, we decided that that was legitimately a fairly cumbersome process and unnecessarily complicated. And so we have agreed to combine those duties into the staffing committee and eliminate the possibility of arbitration to resolve those committee or those concern for safe staffing forms. So this committee will look at larger trends around the hospital that would have implications for safe staffing. And I will stop talking about page 16. Moving on to page 17.
Yeah. I apologize. I mean, Senator this language Abler. Is all new to me. And so I understand delegating conversations. You've been a part of this like every day for the last couple of months. Mm-hmm. So it would help me to know that, you know, the hospitals have been, they've gone from extreme concern to I met with somebody last week, and they're kind of like agreeable to, they can live with a lot of the stuff. And so it helped me to know if they can like live with it. I'm not expecting them to say this is a great idea. And I think, frankly, just my opinion, they dragged their feet too long on this whole topic. We had safe staffing looking for reports, which some of those got sandbagged. And so then partly this is high time. So I'm have a preference that we do something that's useful. It just would help me to know, like on this last thing, these committees, that's kind of worked out to your best understanding, that they're semi-comfortable with it. That would just like that sort of statement would help me. Then I can just focus on other parts of the bill that aren't worked out.
So the existence of these committees is something that I believe everyone is comfortable with. Looking at Danny, do you look comfortable? So the existence of the committees and the structure of them have been dramatically condensed in a way that I believe is not anyone's deep concern. The existence of arbitration in order to, and I don't believe I've gotten to that, but I can tell you that that is an area that remains in contention. What this bill does is it has eliminated any possibility of arbitration as a mechanism for dispute resolution. anywhere at all, except for if the committee cannot agree on a core staffing plan. We have, if you look at the sheet with all the compromises, the first ones that are listed are all relating to arbitration. So we've done a lot of things. We've added clarity around the selection of the arbitrator, about the qualifications of the arbitrator. We have eliminated all possibility of arbitration as it relates to concern for safe staffing forms. We have added a layer of mediation as well, and we've clarified about it being expedited arbitration, I believe. And so, so while that remains an area where we do not see perfectly eye to eye, it is a really important aspect to this bill because right now these hospitals have very similar committees already, but oftentimes they have these conversations, they look at these elements, and then the nurses' voices are ultimately disregarded in creating the core staffing plan. And so that is the point of that arbitration as like a tiebreaker mechanism. But the hope, and in talking with hospitals that have very similar structures, like they have very good relationships with their nurses, nurses are coming back to the bedside, and things seem to be going well. And so like the hope is not that every year every hospital goes to arbitration. Like the hope is that this creates like a really positive, collaborative approach to safe staffing.
Yeah, exactly. And so just since we're clicking through. So
Senator Aper.
Nothing you've brought so far has been extremely controversial anymore. That just helps me so I can. Thank you.
And you're welcome, Senator Aper. And I do think that there is a difference between extremely controversial. I don't think there's anything in this proposal that you would consider extremely controversial. There is still being objections. And something like the issue of even a very narrowly used issue of arbitration is for what I've heard from hospitals still a point of contention, and it is an important feature of the proposal. Yeah. And so while the legislature is a place that is built upon compromise and we sometimes use language like peace in the valley, which is language I don't really like very much, we are, I think, in good faith, we have worked to create something that is the best of the compromise. And while it's not, you know, we're not going to have everybody's support, and the hospitals will be able to speak for themselves, it is, I think, muscular, purposeful, and it balances the concerns that we've heard from various stakeholders along with the intention of what we want to achieve for nurses and safe staffing. And I will... I'll return it to Chair Feist.
Well, thanks, Madam
Senator
Chair.
Abler.
So when you get to that page, I'm just interested in reading the prose. And so out there, one of the reporters said, how do you get 15 and 35 out of 10? Well, actually, you don't. So I think that needs a little bit of wordsmithing to fix that, assuming a group of 10. Mm-hmm. So those are things I can help you with that. So then you don't have to have 100 people to have 15 and 35%. Does that make sense? Want to do math again?
I do not want to do math, but I know I have too many things in my brain, and I can't remember how we resolved that issue, but I know we talked it through.
I think you need a few words.
Yeah. I mean, I'm happy to, if we have a better way to do it. But
Senator Feist, I'm here to help. So there.
Excellent. All right, Chair Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So moving on, we talk about the core staffing plans. And so that is the bottom of page 17 on to page 18. And I am going to I'm going to phone a friend if I can. I think that on line 18.1, I believe that was a major compromise, but we used the word projected a few places in this 31-page bill. So is that the one? I'm looking at Katie. Yeah. Okay, yeah. So line 18.1 is a major compromise. I think some things are a little bit semantics, and I think we found a solution. This is one of those things, like, compromise isn't always just, like, I give and you give and we're both a little bit unhappy. Sometimes you can find language that actually achieves the goal that everyone can live with, and line 18.1 is one of those. We had the word actual. We changed it to projected. We added in some additional language just to ensure that we still are at the, most importantly, is we're understanding how much did a hospital plan to staff a unit, and how much did they actually staff at? I did not explain that with good grammar, but basically the difference between what they planned on and what they actually staffed is what we're trying to get at. And so that language was just wordsmithed in a way that I believe resolves any concerns. Again, page 18 is about the core staffing plan. And at line 18.21, we talk about what the core staffing plan must ensure. And that, again, is something that hospitals generally, and I would say for sure, do already. We're just outlining it here. And we have nurses on the conference committee who can correct me at any point if I'm stating something not precisely accurate. So moving on to page 19, the development of hospital core staffing plans. Again, this is just providing specificity around the considerations when creating a core staffing plans. So these are all things that hospitals do already. We're just making sure that the staffing committee that makes these decisions has a nurse voice that is meaningful. And then moving on to page 20. So on page 20, that's where we get to those lines, Senator Abler, about arbitration. So failure to develop hospital core staffing plans, at line 20.8, 20.14, objections to hospital core staffing plans. Those are scenarios where what we did is we added in a layer of mediation. Hospitals feel really confident that mediation can work, and I think that in a best-case scenario, mediation does work. We've added in that mutually agreed upon arbitrator as a backstop so that if there does need to be a neutral tiebreaker, if the 50-50 committee can't come to agreement, then that would be the mechanism. And I will point you to, I believe it's the final page, when we get to that best practices toolkit, that is on page 28. You'll see that we added in as one of the duties for this convened group of stakeholders, which will, of course, include hospital administrators, that they would include the process for choosing a mutually agreed upon mediator or arbitrator. Because, again, like some of that process doesn't need to be outlined precisely in statute. That would be very prescriptive. But that's kind of how we have addressed in many places throughout this bill the question of arbitration, the cost of arbitration, how necessary arbitration is. And so that is where it is limited to. Did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Abler.
So on line 20.14, objections to hospital core staffing plans. So I'm just curious what circumstance would have a hospital disagree with a plan that its own people agreed to? But, I mean, is that something that you think, does that happen? I'm not a nurse, so.
So in practical terms, Senator Abler, what I understand is that there is a plan, not always clear for the nurses who are practicing. There's a plan. And it is when the nurses encounter issues with staffing that they interact to try and get the staffing that they need.
Yeah. I mean, my question is a minor one.
It is a minor one. So I think, you know, I think it is important that we have language in here that talks about it, but the hospitals, the management of the hospitals have a majority. They have 50%. The nurses have 35%. Direct care staff have 15%. It is hard to imagine that we get to a place where the hospitals themselves would object to their own plan.
I hope it wasn't a dumb question.
Chair Feist.
Okay, thank you. So on page 21, we move into implementation of hospital core staffing plans. And that is where I can point to a few different compromises that we've made. If you look at 21.22, this bill had a number of requirements around public posting of the core staffing plans, and we've really limited that. At line 21.31, you'll see that we've given the hospital staffing committee discretion over the method of public posting. The original version required posting in the patient the hospital room, the patient room, and also like upon admission. And we took all of that out. And so it's really just posting in a public area on the relevant unit. And then we also added in flexibility in terms of how often it needs to be updated at the request of the Minnesota Hospital Association. Moving on to page 22. Again, there's a public posting of emergency department wait times. Senator Abler, you asked where there might be some areas where we're still trying to see eye to eye. That's something that I don't think that hospitals love, but it doesn't seem, it's not one of those key issues, but you asked me to point it out, so I will. We can talk substantive. I'm just doing the walkthrough. So moving on, public distribution, that's an area where we made a compromise. I'm trying to find it. On line 22.15, originally we had a much faster turnaround time for how quickly a hospital must provide that core staffing plan upon request. Now it's 12 hours, and the Hospital Association has said that's workable. Reporting noncompliance, that is all pretty self-explanatory. Documentation of compliance, I haven't heard any strong objections to that. Moving on to page 23.
I just remember there was an issue with this posting. And so you've got away from posting, but a person can request stuff now, and this rating system, is that all kind of gone now? And wasn't there some rating thing? But this posting thing was something that was a mess, as I remember. Like, this was problematic.
Do I have to wait?
Like what?
Chair Feist. There were just much more requirements around where and when to post and who to provide the posting to. And so we've eliminated most of that, and it's just, posting on the unit. And then we've given the hospital discretion over how often
to
change that.
There'll be like one little sign at every unit or something compared to all the rooms. I got it. Well, mm-hmm. I see a lot of movement here, so I'm happy to. Moving into an honorable compromise. Thank you.
Yeah.
Chair Feist.
Thank you. So let's see, where was I? Page 22. We talked again about that distribution, compliance, 23. So the staffing reports. The hospital staffing committee will submit quarterly to the Department of Health their staffing reports. This is where we have criteria to identify if there are situations where the hospital planned to have a certain level of nursing, but then they didn't actually have those nurses. And I'll note that we use the word inappropriate, but it's not a value judgment. It's just a technical term, just to say that, like, was it the anticipated, correct, planned for number of registered nurses in that unit? And that's at line 23.19. And I'm looking to see if there are any compromises I can point to. I don't think so. So that is the report on page 23. Moving on to page 24. Again, we talked about that public posting that's been streamlined and limited. And then moving on to the grading. And I will say that in terms of the remaining issues where there is not seeing eye to eye, I don't know that anybody loves the grading, but it doesn't seem to be like a key area of deep abiding concern. So I can point to some of the specific things that we've done to change it, and I can explain just some things as we head into that section. So moving on to page 25. Grading factors. This is It's a nine-element list, and all of these items in and of themselves do not necessarily relate exclusively to staffing, but collectively they do provide a really good picture of how well-staffed a hospital is. For example, emergency department wait times are not fully within a hospital's control, and we acknowledge that. But it is one factor that, taken through a totality of the circumstances, can provide us a more nuanced understanding of staffing levels. I will point to line 25.7, where we talk about overtime. That was substantially re-engineered in collaboration with the Minnesota Hospital Association to make it a more nuanced and realistic kind of picture of overtime and what it might mean. I will also point to, I think we also made some changes at the request of NAMI Minnesota on this section as well. Moving on to retaliation. So this
Madam
is a
sec.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Senator Abler.
The question about the grading thing, and I imagine this has come up. I really have been unbriefed by hardly anybody, so this is just me looking at this stuff, and I've just heard some rumblings as it's gone forward, and I have to admit I did not study the original version like I might have, even though I was an author. This grading business, I think all those elements make sense. Are you anticipating like a 5-star, 4-star thing, like childcare, or just what are you anticipating that they're going to come up with? Because they're going to look for guidance, and they may be very creative at the Department of Health, but what do you think they're going to, that you would hope they come up with?
You know, I have opinions, but I'm actually thinking maybe other people have more specific thoughts. Like, there will be a lot of, action by the Department of Health to address that question. But if other people have, like, very specific ideas.
Well, Madam Chair, I have a thought.
Senator Abler.
Thank you. What if you don't have grades, but you have, like, just kind of tell us how you did on all those elements so a person can look and... Because, I mean, how are you going to weight the factors? Like, if you had really good turnover, but you had lousy people from underserved communities, I mean, how are you going to weight, though? I just picked two runs and read whatever they were. So maybe if you just had, it's kind of like, how are we doing? And in this area, we did pretty good. And that one, we're trying to get better. I mean, it might be less offensive. And I don't know if that's a flashpoint, but it seems like I'd want to go to an A-rated place than a C-rated one, and maybe they're rated C because they don't have any underserved communities, but they're really great at the care side. So that's my just thought for you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I would point to page 24, line 24.24. So that's where we talk a little bit about what the commissioner of the Department of Health's role will be to develop a uniform annual grading system that evaluates each hospital's compliance with its own core staffing plan. So, I'm interested in what this would look like in the end, but I will say that this particular question has not been the focus of a lot of the conversations I've had with stakeholders. We do say that they will assign a failing compliance grade to any hospital that has not been in compliance with its staffing plan for 6 or more months during the reporting year, and I do think that is reasonable, but I think there's a lot of nuance between like an A and a fail. I think it's a really important aspect of this bill that will provide some transparency and some opportunities for us, the patients, and our families to really understand whether a hospital is safely staffed. Hopefully an incentive.
Well, and just
Senator
the idea
Abler.
And the idea of failing grade, I think that just kind of, you're trying to draw them to better, but I can't imagine a place that out of whatever compliance is with the staffing plan. I mean, in COVID, you can't find people. You're doing the best you can, and now you're failing, and then nobody wants to go work there anyway, and now it's, I just to caution you about monitors. That's all. So I'm glad we're chatting.
Thank you. Chair Feist.
Yep, thank you. Okay, moving on to page 25, retaliation. So this is a really important part of the bill, and I would also point to this as one of the key areas where we have not been able to, like, we call it in lawyer talk, getting to yes. And so what this does is it provides labor protections where professional licensure obligations already permit certain behavior, and whistleblower protections also already protect certain behavior. So if you look at line 26.8, you're going to see that an employer is not allowed to take action against, a nurse who, quote, reasonably determines that accepting an additional patient assignment may create an unnecessary danger to a patient's life, health, or safety, or may otherwise constitute a ground for disciplinary action under the, and that section is the Nurse Practice Act. And so nurses are obligated under state law, under the Nurse Practice Act, to provide safe and effective care. And they are required under the Nurse Practice Act to refuse a patient assignment if it is unsafe for that patient. And so under whistleblower protections, if they were fired for doing so, they could hire a lawyer and they could file a lawsuit and they would win. But that is after the fact. And so what we've seen, and our nurses can tell in their own stories, I don't mean your personal stories, but like you have more specifics, but nurses who are standing up for their license and their profession and their patients are being bullied, they're being docked pay, they are being harassed, they are sometimes being sent home when they're already short-staffed. And so that is a really pervasive issue that this seeks to address, but I cannot emphasize more strongly that nurses are already obligated to do what is described here, which is refuse a patient assignment if they think it is unsafe. This is just providing protections for those nurses who need to do that under their licensure. And so what this does not cover is a nurse who says, I don't feel like working hard on Fridays. Does not cover a nurse who says, I don't want to work with trans patients. It does not cover nurses who don't want to work with violent or mentally ill patients. Like, none of that is permissible under the Nurse Practice Act, and it is not something I see all you nurses, like, that's not something that nurses do. And so I just really wanted to emphasize that, because that is a concern that's been raised, and this does not permit that. They would still be in trouble for doing that. This is only what they are legally required to do already and permitted to do under existing state law. So that is that section.
Madam Chair.
Senator Abler.
And I appreciate this. That was one of the concerns that was expressed to me by the mm-hmm. hospital folks. I'm interested in the fact that nurses are already bound by law to do just what you said. Mm-hmm. So without sitting through more testimony, we're going to hear anyway, but without waiting for that part, have hospitals been asking nurses to do things that would have been not permitted under the statute, and they've been urged or coerced to do that? That's what you were saying then?
Yes. We have heard stories of, I'm seeing all the nurses nodding. I've heard stories of nurses being required to use, like, equipment that they haven't been trained on.
Yeah.
And that's just one story that comes to mind specifically. This is a really common issue.
So this section, not having, I'm skimming it, but so this is really a rehash of current law, trying to put in a practical level for this purpose. There's nothing much new here except for current law. Is that maybe a change from what the draft was before, where it's clarifying that it's kind of clarified current law?
So we did a number of things here. I wouldn't say that is like a core change, but what we did is we added in some language at line 26.11. We added in just some really specific procedures. So a nurse cannot, under this law or the existing law, they wouldn't be able to just decline a patient assignment. There's like a process by which they need to explain and identify other options before they would refuse a patient assignment because it is unsafe. And then the other thing we added at line 26.21 is a retrospective review of the incident. And the goal there is to ensure that, like, if there's a trend, so if nurses are just refusing to accept patient assignments every Friday afternoon, if there's a trend, then they'd be able to get at that there. And that's why we added that. And then I would also point to line 26.22. I think this is incredibly important. It says nothing in this section modifies a nurse's professional obligations under, and those sections are the Nurse Practice Act. Yeah. And so we felt like that was additional comfort language just to make that clear. And we also added in just this afternoon, we added some additional comfort language, and I don't remember exactly what that was. It was just like a few words here and there, but just to make sure that it was like in the nurse's professional judgment, just making it clear, like, it's not because, like, it has nothing to do with them. It has to do with, like, unsafe patient assignment.
Yeah. So. Senator Abler, I think what moving pieces here, we already know under the Nurse Practice Act what a registered nurse, her obligation is, his or her obligation is, their obligation is. We want to make sure that we are prohibiting retaliation against a registered nurse who, in their professional judgment, is making a decision that the employer may disagree with. We want to make sure that those registered nurses are protected against retaliation in that case. And from my perspective, having practiced nursing in a couple of big hospitals, we want nurses not only to be well-prepared, experienced once they're experienced, we want them to be strong advocates for their patients, and in a system that is increasingly broken, that's really, really important. And we want them to be safe in being the strongest advocates that they can be. Within the practice under the Nurse Practice Act and not being jeopardized to the retaliation that might come from an employer that wants them to do something that in their judgment is not right. That's the whole purpose of this section.
No, and I get it, and Madam Chair. And so part of why I'm asking all these questions is, so this draft is new to many, and so it's way new to me. But so if people understand what it says, they'll go like, oh. To me, as I listen to this, it seems reasonable. You add the charge nurse into the discussion. I just don't get to, like, go away, like, we have to have a talk, and she'll say, what could you, or he will say, like, could you, like, just help us a little bit here, and, you know, we'll get you a little extra help, or, so it's kind of the collaborative thing that I expect it would be. And so I'm interested to hear the testimony from the hospitals, but this seems reasonable to me. There may be some little word that I don't get, but thank you.
Yeah.
I see a lot of progress in this. Compared to the world is going to end last year or whenever we did this in the beginning. So, and I think the world is a little safer. So thank you, ma'am.
Joanne, just to make sure that we're following the path that this bill has been on, it's been heard extensively in both the House and the Senate, has been in the Health and Human Services Conference report. So it has not only had multiple compromises, lots of negotiation, but also plenty of public hearing.
Yeah.
And here we are doing that again.
Madam Chair, it shows. And so, but there's sometimes that things get heard in the dozen committees and nothing changes. They go, thank you for sharing, and then off it goes. So that has not been the case here, it seems to me. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Abler. Senator Bolden?
Okay. Chair Feist. Thanks. And I do believe firmly that the best laws are made in a collaborative way, with an open door, listening to all stakeholders, and that's what we've done here. At the top of page 27, speaking of things we've done by listening to stakeholders, there was a private right of action that the Department of Labor and Industry had really wanted in here, but the Hospital Association really didn't want in here, and so we accepted that suggestion from the Hospital Association and took that out. I'm just made a couple of notes of things that I didn't mention as I walked through as we're getting to sort of the end of the bill that I just wanted to mention. This bill had a couple of references in treatment of elective surgeries throughout, and we added some nuance to that definition because an elective surgery is not like always like a tummy tuck or like a cosmetic surgery. Sometimes it's basically, well, I shouldn't say, like, definitionally it's always a pre-scheduled surgery, but we tried to add some nuance, so there's a difference between, like, emergent elective surgeries and urgent elective surgeries. So we added some of that. We also had a fine for failure to report a scheduled elective surgery when a hospital was understaffed, so out of compliance with its core staffing plan. We took out that fine at the request of the Hospital Association. We're just going to trust that they will report when those surgeries are scheduled.
Madam Chair?
Yeah.
Senator Abler.
So speaking of fines, I missed. On the top of page 27, enforcement, what are they actually going to enforce? The labor and industry are going to enforce that last section about the, that would be if there was retaliation. That's what they, okay,
yeah.
Thank you. That's all I need to know.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yeah. And the other thing you made me think of is that there was references or treatment of charge nurses in this bill. So charge nurses ideally would not have patient assignments, but in talking with the Hospital Association, we've understood that sometimes in small, rural, critical access hospitals, they will have patient assignments. So we changed the language to create some strict rules around charge nurses to create more flexibility for the individual hospitals. Because in talking with charge nurses, you know, it's not always an issue, but in talking with other charge nurses, it is often a problematic level of direct patient assignments that charge nurses are given. But in collaboration with the Hospital Association, we ended up kind of tweaking that to make it more flexible. And then the other thing I just wanted to mention, and I don't know if I could find the exact line, but there was language that the Hospital Association was very concerned with where we talked about a maximum number of safe patients that it could be assigned. And the concern was that the interrelation between, like, that maximum number and the possibility of arbitration, like, made the hospitals nervous. And so we did change that language at the request of the hospitals, and in my mind that was a pretty significant compromise. But it's another one of those getting to yes things where you can create language that actually is workable and I think will achieve its goals. And so I just wanted to mention that because that is a new compromise that we made in the last few days. Moving on to page 28, we're getting to the end. So this best practices toolkit was added in after conversations with the Minnesota Hospital Association, just to give this phase-in period where we'd have stakeholders come to the table, because again, like, you can't write, you don't want to be so prescriptive that you're like, every little thing is in here. It's already a long bill. And so we just wanted to make sure that all the stakeholders had an opportunity to come together talk about how this will be implemented, talk about like questions like you had Senator Abler about the grading system, things like that. And again, we added in that language at line 28.14 about the mutually agreed upon mediator or arbitrator, just making sure that process is clear. And so that is the toolkit. We also added at line 28.18, at request of many hospitals, that this stakeholder group must examine whether there are objective metrics by which the commissioner could verify that a hospital is adequately staffed, and that this commission or this stakeholder group must provide recommendations if there is a feasible alternative compliance pathway to ensure adequate hospital staffing. And so we're putting that to this stakeholder group, and we're looking forward to their thoughts by December 15th, 2023. And I would say that I think this is a perfect pathway, but we were willing to compromise on that. And then the Commissioner of Health, again, will be doing some of the work to just develop the analytical tools. Staffing is really complicated. As you've seen, when we're looking at, like, what are those factors, a lot of times you have to really look at the, like, woven web factors and see how they all interplay. And so, we're going to develop tools to really look at staffing in Minnesota. And then the impact evaluation was added in. And if you look at line 29.16, we will look at the impact of this on patient care, nurse job satisfaction, nurse retention, and other outcomes as determined by the commissioner. And we know from studies by, you know, reputable researchers like the National Institute of Health that safe staffing levels directly correlate to patient outcomes and nurse retention. So I think this data will be really valuable, hopefully helpful to other states. And lastly, the workforce report. A bunch of reports, and the commissioner will do things. None of this is controversial. And pretty straightforward. There was something where we added the hospital association by name. I'm not seeing it, but it was at their request, and it was in one of these sections. Here it is, line 30.4, at the request of the hospital association, we listed them out, that they will also be part of the reporting process. And so we look forward to their collaboration on this process. And I think that is it. I think that gives you a good idea of how far this bill has come, how much input we have taken. That input is from a lot of stakeholders, not just associations, but also individual chief nurse officers, CEOs, obviously a lot of nurses have provided their stories. And, this bill is transformed from the beginning of the session to be a much more streamlined, much more clear, a much more workable bill for hospitals, and we're really excited to get it across the finish line.
Thank you, Chair Feist. Senator Abler.
Well, thank you, and I presume we'll be having some testimony. Somebody sent to me that the report, this was posted at like 3:15. So the hospitals that work in legal operations, they may not be able to give you their best answer. Nobody from the hospitals is texting me, so I'm just one random human being said that. So I'm not on anybody's power chain, so I'm just disclaiming that. I think this has come a long ways. And there'll be some testimony, I'll have some questions at the end. And thank you.
Thank you, Senator Abler. With that, I think we would like to move to the public testimony phase of the hearing. And I'd like to invite first Bernie Burnham, who is the president of the Minnesota AFL-CIO. President Burnham, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
All right, thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. I am President Bernie Burnham of the Minnesota AFL-CIO, representing over 300,000 union members throughout the state of Minnesota, and here to speak today on behalf of the Minnesota Nurses Association. So I want to point out that you've accomplished some amazing things already this session. And with less than a week remaining, you have incredible opportunities still before you to deliver for Minnesotans. That includes delivering desperately needed legislation for nurses and patients across the state. We cannot leave them behind. Our nurses, and I say our collectively, our nurses got us all through the pandemic, even when nobody understood the virus, and they did not have the personal protective equipment they needed to keep themselves and their families safe. And instead of leaving during the pandemic, nurses stayed and gave everything they had to care for us, our parents, our grandparents, and our newborn children. We know what nurses need to be able to continue to do what they are called to do. Nurses are asking for a voice in the process to ensure enough staff and better working conditions so that nurses can stay in the jobs they love and provide the exceptional care that all patients deserve. Just like they did in the pandemic, nurses worked hard to keep up with the Keeping Nurses at the Bedside Act, a compromise bill with a flexible local approach to improve staffing. This bill is about taking care of Minnesota patients. Someday, all of us and our loved ones will need care in a hospital. When that day comes, people need to know there are enough skilled nurses at the bedside to provide the safe, high-quality care all patients deserve. Giving our nurses a seat at the table and a voice in the process will help improve staffing levels, bring nurses back to the bedside, and protect patient care throughout this state. This is your chance to finally take care of the nurses who gave us so much to take care of, who gave so much to take care of all of us. After more than 15 years, this is your chance to be the pro-nurse majority that our nurses and all our Minnesota patients need you to be, and pass the Keeping at the Nurses Bedside Act. Thank you very much.
Thank you, President Burnham. Next, I'd like to invite President Mary Turner from the Minnesota Nurses Association.
Good afternoon. My name is Mary Turner. I'm an ICU nurse and currently serving as president of the Minnesota Nurses Association. We represent 80% of the hospital bedside nurses in Minnesota. For more than 15 years, nurses have come to you to ask for help. And each year, hospital administrators ask you not to interfere with their businesses and to leave these decisions up to them. This year, they really upped their false rhetoric and even resorted to blackmail threats. These threats are not only to the safe staffing standards all patients deserve, they are threats to our democracy. From the bargaining table to the legislature, our hospital executives have told us there is nothing they can do to improve staffing levels and retain nurses. Now those same executives are telling you legislators that there is nothing you are allowed to do to address these same issues. Again today, nurses are pleading with you to intervene. The old way of doing things isn't working. MNA collects Concern for Safe Staffing data from nurses when, in their professional judgment, they believe patients are at risk to be harmed or even have been harmed due to understaffing. The most recent data showed that nearly 90% of the time when nurses sound the alarm that staffing was unsafe and patients were at risk, management did not help resolve the staffing concern or simply did not respond at all to their calls for help. Did not respond. At the same time, adverse health events went up 33% for hospital patients last year. That means Minnesotans were more likely to have wrong limbs amputated, have surgery performed on the wrong patient, or even suffer sexual assault or death inside our hospitals. Nurses are carrying the burden of unsafe staffing, increased patient needs, and escalated stress from living through a global pandemic. We see this all come to a head with the increased violence and abuse nurses and patients experience in our hospitals. A study last spring found that for every hour in the day, two or more nurses are assaulted. I repeat, at least two nurses are assaulted every single hour by patients, family members, and visitors. It is not that it is no exaggeration to say our profession is in crisis. That is why thousands of nurses are walking away from the bedside. But that crisis is not that we do not have enough nurses. We actually have 2 registered nurses for every nursing job in the state. So regardless of the false rhetoric, lies, and threats you have heard since we introduced this legislation, nurses and other healthcare workers come to you in good faith to work together to fix this crisis and keep nurses at the bedside. We didn't leave you guys behind, so don't leave us behind. We desperately need you to pass this legislation and finally provide healthcare workers with the support we need to provide quality patient care and stay in the career that we love and we value. And I want to say one last thing. The nurses for 15 years have come here, not out of their own self-interest. And when we fight for our career and we fight for our profession, we are ultimately fighting for the patients of Minnesota and ultimately fighting for the people of Minnesota. And that has always been our motivation and always will. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I'd like to ask next Mary Krinke from the Minnesota Hospital Association. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Krinke.
Madam Chairs, both of you, thank you for this opportunity to share some of our concerns. I do want to acknowledge that we have been working with many legislators, but most of the changes that have been made we consider are still pretty much the smaller changes, and we still have significant concerns that I would like to share with you. I will go quickly through these and be happy to have any follow-up conversations if conference committee members have questions. Number one on page 15 is language regarding the committee makeup of the staffing committee. And we have a number of our hospitals with collective bargaining agreements, and they have asked that their committee structure that they have in their collective bargaining agreements could stay in place. So we had requested language that would specifically say current staffing committees, if they are approved by a collective bargaining agreement, those committees could stay, and the language does not address that concern. Number two, on page 18, and this was an issue, as Representative Feist did acknowledge, this is the issue of putting together your staffing plan. So it is on a prospective basis. It is not after the fact. It is prospective. And we had requested that it reads the number of patients, and we had requested that it would read either the estimated number of patients, because this is in your staffing plan ahead of time. And in our last discussions with Representative Feist, she had agreed to change it to the ideal number of patients. And I don't know if this is just an omission or if something else happened with that, but we would certainly like the words either estimated or ideal to be added on line 18.3. The third issue that I would like to bring to your attention, and this issue has had a lot of discussion, and this is the issue of mediation versus arbitration. And we know that potentially with a staffing committee that's based on 50-50, you could potentially reach an impasse. We would like to give mediation a chance. We have drafted language for consideration by the committee, and I have that with me today, and I'm happy to share that with you. I want to remind people that arbitration comes from the word arbitrary. And it would be with a judge, it would be with lawyers, it would be in a courtroom. We contend that staffing decisions need to be made by healthcare professionals in a timely manner and within the walls of a hospital. We have said, let's use a professional mediator. The language is the current language in many of the collective bargaining agreements. So we're requesting that if there's an impasse at the staffing committee, let's try mediation first. And we have language that says we would like to have mediation for a 3-year period. We would be willing to report back to the Commissioner of Health how long that mediation process took and how many times it was used. We believe that probably 90% of our hospitals won't even need to use mediation, but we do not want to have to hire lawyers to decide staffing decisions made in a courtroom. The fourth issue that I want to bring to your attention, and Representative Feist did mention this, this is the definition of elective surgery on page 23. We don't think that definition has been changed. We are appreciative that the fine has been taken out of the bill. I want people to understand that an elective procedure includes cancer care, it includes brain tumors, it includes anything that is pre-scheduled. So we would really like to have a definition of elective procedures there that basically would at least acknowledge that these are scheduled procedures. I think a lot of people, when they hear the word elective, they think it's hip or knee surgeries. It really is very significant surgery, so we would like to have a definition there. Number five, this is an issue that has been discussed, and it is one of our major contentious items. And this is the language regarding a nurse refusing a patient assignment. Once again, we have language here that we are suggesting to the committee. This is language that has been taken from several of the collective bargaining agreements in the Twin Cities. We believe that a nurse should go to their charge nurse, they should go to their chief nursing officer, and they should ask for additional help. We do believe and have already heard many stories from our members that nurses are already starting to question reproductive health care, transgender health care, violent patients. And once a patient has been admitted to the hospital, a hospital has to provide care for that patient. We can't have nurses refusing to provide care to a patient. And quite frankly, if one nurse says they don't want to care for a patient, that means the other nurses on the unit have more patients to care for. So we really don't want that language to be in statute, in law, that a nurse can refuse a patient. I have alternative language for the committee to consider. And finally, my point number six is the issue of the Mayo exemption. This is a very difficult topic for us to discuss. The original language was based on a patient acuity model. We believe that that patient acuity model is the right approach to go rather than an exclusive carve-out. We also believe that that patient acuity model should be available to all hospitals. And we know that technology is advancing and that patient acuity models really can help with staffing. Now, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't have a staffing committee. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't have safe staffing forms. So I want to be clear. We have agreed that there should be a staffing committee. We have agreed that nurses should have a procedure for filing staffing complaints, and those should be reviewed by the staffing committee, and they should be sent, if they're unresolved, to the Department of Health. But as you can see, we have significant concerns still left, and we're hoping that this conference committee, I know there's not a lot of time left, but we're hoping that our concerns can still be addressed. So, Madam Chair, if it's okay, I have just a one-page handout. I want people to know that we are working on this arbitration language and have proposed mediation, and we have taken language directly out of collective bargaining agreements on patient refusal.
Thank you, Ms. Krinke.
Madam Chair, you're going to take any questions or later or something? Maybe later, huh? Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator Abler. Thanks. Thank you. I would like to invite next Pastor James Erlinson.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Pastor. If you'd introduce
Chair.
Yourself.
Yes, I'm Pastor James Erlinson, pastor of Lutheran Church of the Redeemer in St. Paul, and also part of Isaiah. As clergy, I spend a lot of time in hospitals visiting patients for spiritual care. And so I know how critically important nurses are to patient care. I also have nurses in my family and as members of my congregation. And I speak on their behalf today as well as for all patients needing care. I clearly remember during the pandemic when hospitals and care centers were closed to visitors Only nurses, physicians, medical staff, hospital staff were allowed to have personal contact for patient safety and community protection. Nurses continued to show up to care for their patients who were our families, our friends, loved ones, and neighbors. I also clearly remember photos that my niece, who is a maternity ward nurse in Dallas, shared with her family, photos she shared with her family and friends on social media. They showed the face shields, the masks, the protective clothing that she wore in every shift, which were inadequate protection in the dark days before vaccines and N95 masks were sufficiently available. So she had two young children at home, a husband, and so they were all at risk as well. I remember those days very well. But she and thousands of nurses continued to work at risk to their own health and their family's health. We are very grateful for their courageous care, their work, and their dedication. So they helped hold our Minnesota community together at the front line throughout the pandemic. But it took a toll, and we all know that there are nurses who have been forced to leave their profession because of burnout or other health concerns, and now we have a shortage of nurses in Minnesota. Nurses have a very simple ask in this bill. They are asking for a seat at the table to improve working conditions and also to ensure that there are enough staff to provide the care that we need when we and our families need hospital care. So I support our nurses and urge you to pass the Keeping Nurses at the Bedside Act. Every nurse in every hospital in Minnesota deserves this. Thank you.
And following Ms. Johansson will be Becky Nelson, and then Joseph Schulte. Ms. Johansson, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Kate Johansson, and I represent Mayo Clinic. First of all, thank you so much for the time. I see many friendly and familiar faces around this table. And although we didn't necessarily expect to see you so soon, of course, we are happy to be here to provide feedback on this bill, because we have worked for weeks and months and traded drafts and ideas and discussions and cookie preferences and, yes, emails over this very important topic. So as you have heard me say many times, for Mayo Clinic, everything comes down to what is in the best interest of patients. How do we give them the highest possible standard of care, the care for which we are globally renowned and which our patients expect when they come to Mayo Clinic as a destination for hope and healing? We do not take that lightly. And our staff and how we staff is essential and fundamental to the kind of care that Mayo Clinic can provide. You've also heard me say in our numerous weeks of discussion how Mayo's staffing model represents a standard that we think represents the type of nurse model, the nurse staffing model, that is most appropriate for any Minnesota system to achieve. Indeed, while we understand the approach that's reflected here in a committee structure, we believe that Mayo's model is already far more advanced and, frankly, essential to providing the care for which we are known. We think that an alternative pathway reflective of this model that any system could achieve would be appropriate for this committee to consider. The model that we propose would actually require more input from nurses than is recommended under this committee model. It would require patient needs through the form of acuity data to help inform staffing in a dynamic and flexible way. And the language that we have provided for your consideration would also require patient outcomes, actual patient impacts, to be validated against patient outcome data. It is still our preference that you would please consider this alternative pathway, that this bill would include not only the proposed committee structure, but also this enhanced pathway that would have additional oversight, more nurse input, a patient acuity consideration, and validated data against these outcomes that, frankly, that committee pathway would not be subject to. I do want to clarify with you, it sounds like your intent would be to exclude all of Mayo Clinic from the proposed committee model. Can you please clarify for me if that is the intent of this new language? And I'll just note that we are just reviewing this language in real time, so that's the purpose of my question.
Yes, that is our intent. We have been told to do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative.
If I could, just to be clear, thank you. It's not based on an acuity tool model or any type of exceptional patient care or nurse input. It is just because we've been told to do it.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Johansson.
Oh, pardon me. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Feist. I want to be clear that Mayo Clinic is not telling you to do that. We are saying, please judge us against the standard of our excellent care and a staffing model that we believe serves nurses and patients very well. And that is why, again, we would encourage you to please consider the language that we've provided for several weeks that provides a pathway for any hospital that wants to achieve that standard. I would also note that the language currently in this bill, and again, this is very new language to us, if your intent is to exempt Mayo Clinic, the language that you currently have likely does not accomplish that objective for any of our sites. And so I would simply request, again, I know things are very fast moving, but time to review this language and provide thoughtful feedback so that you could achieve your stated intent, even if we do not agree with it, would be in the best interest of everyone involved. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions and appreciate, again, the committee's time.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Johansson. Next, we invite Becky Nelson, then Joseph Schulte, and then John Welsh.
Good afternoon. My name is Becky Nelson. I'm a registered nurse. I work at Alina Zapp at Northwestern Hospital. I work in perianesthesia, which is part of surgical services. I am the chair of the Minnesota Nurses Association Government Affairs Commission, and I know how vital it is for safe staffing legislation to pass. I'm a 20-year nurse. Nurses have been coming to the Capitol for more than two decades, asking for something to be done to solve the crisis of understaffing in our hospitals. And this year, even as this bill has made it further than it has ever had, nurses have experienced huge amounts of stress, obstacles, and really even blackmail to get this far. MNA nurses are deeply concerned that Mayo is seeking to undermine the safe staffing standards that we need across the state. That includes deep concerns by Mayo nurses, many of whom are too scared to speak publicly about it. It is not hard to see why they would be intimidated by Mayo when they work closely with the National Right to Work Foundation to spread misinformation about unions, sabotage union activity, and desert union hospitals. These are the same tactics they are now using against you, the legislators, and all Minnesotans to hold on to their corporate power and profits. If even our state's highest elected officials, including Governor Walz, are intimidated by Mayo, you can imagine what it is like to work for them. The patients in Southeast Minnesota deserve the same staffing protections as every other patient in the state. They deserve to know that when they or their loved ones walk into a hospital, they will get the care that they expect and deserve from highly skilled professionals. The nurses working in the Mayo Health System deserve the peace of mind knowing that their patients will receive timely, appropriate nursing care, even when they have the very complex conditions that Mayo accepts or they need intense one-on-one care. To the nurses and the patients at Mayo, please know the brave nurses of MNA have been fighting for you this entire session. Mayo executives have fought to silence, sideline, and subvert your voice, your concerns, and your well-being. When nurses see patients and families in the hospital, it's on their very worst days. Nobody comes to the hospital when everything is going great. On those days, patients and nurses across the state deserve these protections and the peace of mind that they will receive safe, dedicated, and high-quality care. So without action, the problems are only getting worse in our Minnesota hospitals. Nurses' reports of situations where short staffing negatively impacts patient care have really skyrocketed to more than 8,400 last year, and more than 50% of nurses are considering leaving the bedside due to understaffing. 2,400 Minnesota nurses out of the Minnesota Nurses Association left bedside jobs last year. This is a crisis of retention, and it is a crisis of patient care. Every patient deserves to walk into a hospital and know they'll receive timely, high-quality care. The good news is that more than 80% of nurses who left the bedside last year did indicate some willingness to come back to the bedside if staffing and working conditions improve, and that was surveyed by us. That means more than 2,000 nurses are ready to return if the Minnesota legislature can take action and improve our working conditions this year. Regardless of what you've heard throughout the session, the only consequences of this bill are safer staffing in our hospitals, more transparency so the public knows what's happening inside their hospitals, and better patient care. We are pleading with you, with the Minnesota legislature, to finally please pass this vital legislation and help fix the crisis within our hospitals. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Nelson. I'd invite Mr. Schulte, and following Mr. Schulte, John Welsh. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Joseph Schulte, and I'm the Public Affairs Coordinator for AFSCME Council 65, and I am here today to speak on behalf of over the 3,000 LPNs and other direct care workers we represent at 42 healthcare facilities across Greater Minnesota. But first, I want to thank the authors and the Nurses Association for working hard to make a bill and work with us to make a bill that covers all direct care workers in our hospitals and improve the workplace for everybody. But from International Falls to Winona and Windham, our members' workplaces are facing a severe safety and staffing crisis. To put it as simply as I can, our hospitals are not always safe places to work. In this room, I think we are all aware of some of the risks healthcare workers face during the pandemic, not only to themselves, but to their loved ones. So many of our members moved out of their own homes to keep their families safe. And I truly don't think this gets enough attention. At times, working in healthcare can make the workers themselves a risk to those around them. If that's not enough to worry about, workplace violence is rising. When over 75% of our nurses have observed or experienced physical violence in the workplace, we have a problem. Healthcare workers are leaving the field at record rates, and many who leave cite safety, workloads, and stress as primary reasons. It is incredibly difficult to recruit healthcare workers in rural facilities, which is why we must do everything we can to retain the amazing workers we already have. With workers stretched thinner than ever, the risk of instances of violence are higher than ever. A patient experiencing traumatic events or mental health crisis can quickly require multiple staff to de-escalate. Especially in rural health facilities, every staff available can make a difference between workers going home safely and a workplace injury. All of this is to say, safety is a huge issue, and the Keeping Nurses at the Bedside Act is the solution. In a hospital, every person contributes to providing quality patient care and workplace safety, but direct care workers face the highest risk. Currently, most of them are shut out of the planning process for safety and staffing in their workplaces. Workers, patients, and their families all deserve to know that every hospital is staffed with direct care workers who had a voice in the safe staffing plan. Without the hospital and their staffing committees in Section 11 of this bill, there is no guarantee that their input or experience will be considered in staffing decisions. The Keeping the Nurses at the Bedside Act will help ensure our members can provide Minnesotans with the best possible care when they need it the most. This session includes some of the most amazing improvements to worker safety, including for warehouse, refinery, railway, and other workers. Now it's time to do the same for our healthcare workers. That is why we ask you to pass the Keeping Nurses at the Bedside Act. Minnesota can and should be the safest state for workers.
Thank you, Mr. Schulte. John Welsh, following Mr. Welsh, it's Mr. Varco. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. My name is John Welsh, and I'm a med-surg nurse at Unity Hospital in Fridley. I want to speak today on the proposal in Keeping Nurses at the Bedside Act that it prohibits retaliation against nurses who raise concerns about the appropriateness of their assignment. This doesn't happen every day, but it does occur too often, and nearly every nurse you'll meet will have their own story. For me, it was my first year on the job, and I got floated to the surgical floor, And I was given an assignment that included two bariatric patients who needed complicated follow-up on the post-operative day one to ensure the success of their surgery. I had no such training. I raised my concerns, but it was immediately dismissed. I was the rookie. The assignment did not seem right to me, and honestly, I should have pushed this issue, but I didn't. I was scared I was just going to get into trouble, and I just thought, well, maybe they know better. So I took the assignment. About 15 minutes into my shift, a veteran nurse looked over my shoulder and asked me, why do you have these patients? She flat out told me, you are not qualified to care for these patients. She immediately went to up the chain of command and got me a new appropriate assignment. I'm a new nurse. I was just trying to do my job. I was made to feel foolish for questioning my assignment. These are the types of binds that nurses can find themselves in, and the stakes are so high. Our patients' lives are on the line, and our nursing license is certainly on the line. We tried to address these issues during negotiations at every table in the Metro Duluth the contract negotiations last year. At Allina Health, we have similar language as Kanaba, but there is a crucial, meaningful difference. Under our contract in Kanaba, a nurse can escalate their concerns to the charge nurse and the nursing supervisor. Both proposals, both the contract and Kanaba outline how the dispute can be resolved. But where the difference is at the end of all the discussion and if the nurse still feels the assignment is unsafe. In our contract, the nurse is sent home, and that happens. During COVID, a nurse was assigned two critically ill patients that were supposed to be one-to-ones with one nurse, and they were assigned two. She was told, well, they're just next door to each other. You can do it. They sent her home. She would refuse assignment. They sent her home. That's what, under Kanaba, the nurse would go through the same process, but at the end, if she or he did not agree to the assignment, they would receive a new and safer assignment. This nurse showed up for work. We should not be sending nurses home when our units are already understaffed. This is to keep the nurse on the job at the bedside. What the provision does is protects the nurses who has concerns, and it protects the patients who need safe care. This bill is about retraining nurses and keeping them at the bedside to protect patient care. We should not be sending good nurses home who take the brave step to speak up to protect their licenses and their patients. Thank you very much. And chairs, thank you so much for your work on this proposal.
Thank you, Mr. Varco.
Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Rick Varco for the record. I'm the political director for SEIU Healthcare Minnesota and Iowa. Our union represents 50,000 healthcare workers around the state in hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, and self-directed home care. We urge your support for the Keeping Nurses at the Bedside Act. The bill will help ensure staffing levels and other conditions at hospitals are safe for patients and workers. We appreciate that the staffing committees created by the bill include not just direct care registered nurses, but also other direct care workers like health unit coordinators and nursing assistants we represent. These workers would be part of the committees, and we know they are eager to share their expertise, experience, and concerns about patient care. Every day, our members work side by side with nurses in hospitals to deliver top quality care. We share the same employers, and we see how those employers can too often put profits before patients. The COVID epidemic reinforced the principle that quality care depends upon the whole team. We also share the concerns that have been raised about violence and hospital worker safety. Workplace violence was a major topic at our last member convention last year, and our members passed a resolution in support of legislation to improve the safety and healthcare workplaces and the mental health of caregivers subjected to workplace mistreatment. We think this bill includes helpful provisions, including the mandatory safety plans to create a safer workplace. Healthcare workers face staffing shortages across a variety of sectors and programs. We believe we can best address the workforce crisis by providing workers with a greater voice over their working conditions. The same burnout that drives so many RNs from the field also impacts our members who work alongside them every day. Hospital staffing committees will help hospitals better retain workers and help them attract new workers to the field. This bill gives nurses and other direct care staffers a stronger voice, which helps them make their jobs better and more attractive. Thank you, and we encourage you to support the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Barco. And last is Margaret Kelly from the Department of Health. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Kelly, and if you'd state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Margaret Kelly, Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health. And I'm here to speak to a few of the provisions in the bill that we do have concerns about. But first, I would just like to say a thank you to all of our healthcare partners on the front line and the midline and the back line who helped Minnesotans stay safe during the pandemic. I don't have a copy of the bill in front of me. I was working off a previous version, but I believe it is on page 24, the grading system, 24 to page 25. That has all of the components that the Department of Health must consider when we're putting together the grading system. We do not have expertise in this. And our preference from the beginning was that you would define what a grade A, a grade B, and a grade C would be for us, and that we would simply evaluate the staffing plans against that grading system. Instead, in the bill, you're leaving it up to us to design the grading system, and we are required to look at data. You have a long list of the data we're supposed to look at. We do not have access to that data. At a minimum, you would need to require hospitals to submit that data to us as they submit their staffing plans. We're not sure if those are the right factors to look at. We would prefer that it be a may and not a must, so that we can, as we evaluate what the right grading system would be, determine what the right factors are to look at. But our preference would be that you outline in law what the grading system would be. And if that's not possible, then we would request there be an additional stakeholder group that's established, I believe it's in section 19, that would work with us to determine what that grading system will be. Those are our main concerns around the grading system, is that I'm certain that the Department of Health will not provide the grading system that everybody's looking for, no matter how good we are at that work. But we will do a good job of regulating against a grading system you all define for us. We also are requesting, it's in section 19 of the bill, I believe, you have us doing stakeholder groups, one for the toolkit and one to design, the same stakeholder group to design an alternative pathway. Our preference would be that you allow us to do separate stakeholder groups, not sure it would be the same people who would be helpful on both, to design both of those elements of this bill. The December 15th due date, December 23rd, is not a workable due date for the department. The requirement to put together stakeholder groups, to contract for assistance and expertise on those, to facilitate those stakeholder groups, will take us 3 months' time. And that would only give us a few months to actually do the work. Some of the work of the stakeholder groups could extend beyond December 15th, but our request would be that we have a stakeholder group for the toolkit, one for an alternative pathway, and that we be able to deliver that report before legislative session, maybe in middle of February of next year, and that we have a third stakeholder group to help design the grading system for us. Finally, there is a analytical tools you're asking us to do. I'm not sure the section. I think the line is around line 28.30, where we're to identify any causal links. And we're not certain that there is data that that's something we could do with data, is identify causal links, but perhaps change that to correlations. And that is the requests that we're making of the committee. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Kelly. Chair Feist. Yeah, thank you. We've been working with you for a while on this, so this is helpful. We would have loved to have had this input a little bit earlier, but we're happy to work with you on it.
Appreciate that.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner.
Someone left their glasses here.
Hopefully someone will be able to see the glasses that they have left behind. All right, I would before, and members, we are gonna, we've concluded the testimony, there'll be time for questions. I would like to get our fiscal staff to just go over the fiscal document that's before us. So I'd ask that we proceed with that, and then we can do a little question and answer.
Madam Chair, members, Doug Berg, House Fiscal Staff. You had passed out a single page, very short spreadsheet. This is based on information that had been put together by the Health Department on tracking this and represents what we believe is left in the draft at this point. Just very quickly going down on, if you go to line 3, is the money for the loan forgiveness for nurses program. That's 10.6 million in 24-25 and 10.6 million in 26-27. Line 4 is the loan forgiveness for the instructors portion, which is 132,000 in 24-25 and 132,000 in the tails. Line 5 is the nursing workforce report, the data sharing agreement with the Minnesota Hospitals Association. That has a cost of $782,000 in 24-25. Line 6 is the nurse core staffing plan, safe staffing form, and data portal. That has a cost of $636,000 in 24-25 and $836,000 in the tails. Line 7 is the workforce report, which has a cost of $101,000 in 24-25 and $202,000 in the tails. Then line 8 is the best practices toolkit, which is listed at $178,000 in 24-25. Moving down to line 11 is funding for the Department of Human Services, direct care and treatment, mental health and substance abuse area, budget area. Beginning on line 14 and 15, and then a total, net total on line 16 is the Department of Labor and Industry costs. Related to the retaliation section, that is got a cost, net cost of $130,000 in 24-25 and a net savings of $266,000 in the tails. And then finally on line 18 is the MMB impact evaluation, which has a cost of $232,000 in 24. If you go to line 21, you'll see the total impact all agencies on this of 18.7 million in 24-25, 26.7 million in the tails for a total over 4 years of 45.1 million. And Madam Chair, I'll note there is no appropriation section in the draft you went through. My understanding is that all the appropriations still will be carried in Senate File 2995, the Health and Human Services Finance Bill.
Thank you very much for that, and that is our understanding as well. Senator Abler.
Well, thanks. Just to the fiscal note. So I presume these are all worked out, and is this already being, not knowing what's in the other conference report, are these numbers being carried there now as they are?
Madam Chair, Senator Abler, as of before, just before the start of this meeting, yes, they are on the spreadsheet in the other committee. That bill is not closed yet, but it is the costs for this bill are in that spreadsheet.
All right, so Madam Chair, I don't want to snag up that bill any more than it already is, but well, I appreciate that. I just have a question. And the number 7, the workforce report, that's not tails. That's just a 3-year cost, and then that's the end of it? Or is that ongoing?
Madam Chair, I'm uncertain. It looks to me, and I don't know, I got called in on this, it looks to me like there is an annual report beginning in 25, since those costs are the same. That would be my guess.
Madam Chair, then continuing.
Senator Abler.
It's a perpetual report then. It'll be every year for some time.
Yes.
Thank you. Cool. So if you like these numbers, you don't have to do anything about that. You just, it's in the spreadsheet, so you could choose to approve the spreadsheet or not, but it's going to go forward. Okay.
Senator Abler, I don't think that we obviously can talk about the spreadsheet as it relates to the bill, but we don't have the power to change the spreadsheet because that's happening in another committee. Though if we made significant changes to the bill, those changes would then be accounted for in the spreadsheet in the other proposal.
Yeah. So as I was looking at this, I don't know that what we're talking about would have much impact on this, it seems to me. So it's just nice to put that to rest. So at least we can
thank you, Senator
get something
Abler.
Done today. Thank you.
Members, what I would like to do, what I'd like to propose for us, now that we've concluded the public testimony and the walkthrough of the proposal and they're beginning to take votes in the Senate, is that I would like at this point to propose a recess to the call of the chair to give people time so that we can go vote and then to come back a little bit later this evening to take action on the proposal.
Madam Chair.
Senator Abler.
So I'm good with the word action. I hope you're not to final action tonight. I think that this has been, I think you can get done by tomorrow. I think there's a bunch of amendments you need, clearly, even just technical ones. And I have a number that I think will help you to just clean up some stuff. And I haven't thought it all the way through, but I think with respect to the people who have legal advice to get and at least advise us their best. We heard from the Department of Health that we need to kind of decide what to tell them to do. That can't be done on the fly even this evening. But so I'm happy to spend here as long as we all need, but I just would suggest to the chair and to the interested parties that if we could maybe do what you can tonight and then come back at noon or something tomorrow and just be decided to be done by the afternoon. I think that would be an expeditious time, especially if we know we're not going to be dragging the other bill into trouble because you've already agreed to the numbers. That's a suggestion. So thank you.
Thank you for the advice. Are there other questions or comments? Representative Davids.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. One of the witnesses made an accusation that Mayo intimidated Governor Walz. I'd like to know more about that intimidation, or is it the fact that Mayo made a decision on what they would do if certain things happened and presented it to Governor Walz? That's not intimidation, that's just stating facts. So if there's intimidation, I mean, I can't imagine Governor Walz being intimidated by anybody, but I'd like to know, that's a very, very serious charge that Mayo intimidated Walz. I don't believe it for a second. But if we could have any follow-up on that, I'd really appreciate that.
Thanks, Representative Davids. I would put that into the category of one person's opinion and one person's testimony. Senator Abler.
Well, Madam Chair, I have some questions for the hospitals. If we're not rushed to the floor, because there's a couple things I'd like to ask them. Is that all right? Or what do you?
Yeah, Senator Abler, it is.
We can do it tonight. I don't mind, but later. You're the chair. I'm happy to help. I just, at some point, I'd like to ask some questions of the hospitals. I'm going to ask them in particular, just so they can prepare. I've been attuned to this arbitration thing. If I look at the language that people are worried about on 26 point, wherever the arbitration language is after mediation, but it seems like I want to have them tell me what we're worried about if. They want mediation, which is there, and then no arbitration, but I'm going to ask them, if mediation doesn't work, then what do you do? That's my question. For start, that's probably the biggest question I have.
So while they're here, Senator Abler, I think it makes sense that you have the opportunity to ask them the questions that you want.
I don't want to mess up your schedule. So, I mean, they're going to come back tonight if you want to take a break. So, as you wish, Madam Chair.
Senator Abler, do you think that question and answer period would last more than 10 minutes or so?
We could have 10 minutes.
Should we try for 10 minutes, Senator Abler?
I can do that.
All right. Do you think Ms. Krinke would come back to the witness table?
Or maybe Ms. Johansson, and I don't know how many of the hospital people testified. Whoever testified, they could just be a little mini panel and we can ask them our question. All
right. Well, I would invite either Ms. Krinke or Ms. Johansson back.
Both?
Yeah. Either or both, if they'd like to come back for a couple of questions. And as I indicated, we are starting to vote on the floor.
Right.
And so I would like us to go and do that work as well. Chair Feist?
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to mention that it's been proposed that a chief nurse officer could be a tiebreaker in the event of deadlock in these staffing committees. And that would just mean that management, the administration at the hospital, would have one more vote. And so that wouldn't be a truly neutral tiebreaker. So I just wanted to mention that. Yeah.
And the reason I'm asking the question is I've heard from, actually, when I said no one was talking to me, they're all talking to me now. So I feel, Madam Chair, I feel much more special than I felt. I wasn't like begging. It is my birthday on top of that. So it's like, it's just special all around. And there's another birthday in the room. I don't know where she's hiding, Ms. Cunningham. But anyway.
Senator Abler.
Thank you. But I'm not a, they have said in these texts and in comments that this, the process works. We work together and we don't even need mediation hardly ever. So I don't know that having a 6-5 or some vote where one side has the advantage is, it's not working apparently, and I'm satisfied with an even number. But so I'm not trying to get you to any other ratio than 50-50, but it seems like I would think especially in some of the areas that they're used to collaborating now, that they would continue to collaborate and you'd never even need a mediator. And like they suggested this state one, but it says they have to have an agreed upon one. So I mean, I think we're close. And I just wanna ask Ms. Krinke if you can explain to me the specter of the arbitrator versus what you're really afraid of. And I'm friendly to your comments, and we've had a few chats about this, but I just kind of need to know. So,
Madam Chair, and Madam Chair, and Senator Abler, as Representative Feist noted, when we first talked about this committee and what would happen if there was an impasse, we pointed out that the states of Illinois, New Jersey, and Colorado all have required mandated staffing committees, and their law states that the chief nursing officer would be the tiebreaker. And that is because CMS rules say that a chief nursing officer is responsible for all staffing within a hospital, both nurse staffing and all staffing. And that is CMS rules for Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement. And we shared that information with Representative Feist. And she didn't really like that because chief nursing officers are part of management. So we said, well, how about we try mediation? And that is language that is found in many of the collective bargaining agreements, and we thought that that was already a compromise. I would like to point out that arbitration is used by police and firefighters and our public employee unions, and it is always about wages and salaries and benefits. But those public employee unions are not allowed to strike. And that is a significant difference here. So we support the collective bargaining process. We recognize that nurses are allowed to strike, and that is the ultimate decision maker if you don't like what's in the staffing plan. And so I think we need to stick with mediation, and that's something that our members feel strongly about. So thank you, Senator Abler.
Senator Abler, and then Representative Berg.
Yeah, so Madam Chair, it's what we're building on here is a long history of operations and, in many cases, a fair amount of distrust some pent-up angst on both sides, which is why I guess there's a legislature. And I don't know if we need arbitration or not. It seems like you're never going to get there, and it seems, Ms. Krinke, I'm just, stay here, please, if you don't mind. I mean, I'm just trying to sort this out. And so if most places never even get to mediation, do you think people are just going to want to blow right through mediation to get to arbitration? Is that what you think, is that they're just not going to work as hard at mediation? If there's a, it seems, given what I've seen of the goodwill of the nurses I know, and actually there's a few hospitals that could do a little better, but I think especially with this, they're going to be realizing that it's time to start working on this stuff. But I think in good faith, they're going to come. And I don't know if you need arbitration, but I am concerned if if having arbitration means you're not going to try to really mediate because you always have this other thing you think you're going to win at it, then it would be a dangerous thing to have. But if mediation is truly going to work and people are sincerely committed to that, then that's my question. So I don't know what even to add more ask.
Thank you, Senator Abler.
Yeah, so so my question is, do you think in places where you have where there's been a cooperative or at least a working system and you don't hardly need mediation, do you, Ms. Krenke, do you see that having arbitration past mediation would help people be less cooperative in a mediation time?
Madam Chair, Senator Abler, that is precisely our worry. We're afraid that if arbitration is the outlier, that's where people will run to immediately, that they won't try to work collaboratively together, that we'll lawyer up and we'll go to court, and that's how we'll decide our staffing plans. And we really truly believe that it will be very disruptive to our culture that we have within our hospitals. We want our chief nursing officers to work with our nurses, and mediation brings people together. You bring in a federally qualified mediator, and they put you in a room, and they bring in coffee, and you sit there, and you hack it through it. And we're very afraid that this provision will just be a conflict and add contentiousness, and we're hoping that we can get things done through mediation if that's necessary.
Yeah, thank you. So I don't want to cause that, but I would hope that it seems like the goodwill is that they're going to try mediation. So that's all. Thank you. I'm done.
Thank you, Senator Abler. Representative Berg?
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. I appreciate having a chance to also ask a question, or actually an explanation. I've spent I don't know how many hours in mediations and arbitrations in my work. For those that don't know, I'm a flight attendant, and I'm a rank and file union member. And we are allowed to strike, and we also have mediation and arbitration processes. So I just wanted to make that clear that it's not just one type of union over the other. And oftentimes, to your point, Senator Abler, management and the employees come to the table with the best of intentions of coming up with an outcome that is fair to both sides. Sometimes that just can't happen, so you move on to mediation, and that is the preferable situation to end up in, is mediation. And it's collaborative, it's oftentimes not super combative, again, with the absolute intention of an outcome that befits everybody. But sometimes that also is not possible, so you go to what we consider a backstop, which is arbitration, which is you just absolutely cannot come up with a decision. And so you need someone to come in who is neutral, who isn't necessarily a subject expert, so they're not going to take like a super technical position, and they're not going to take what someone might consider an emotional decision. They are actually neutral, and they look at the facts as presented, and then they make that decision. So I don't think that we need to spend time discussing whether or not mediation is better than arbitration. We know that it is, and we know that they're not going to skip the mediation step. The arbitration is the absolute last resort, and one hopes that we don't get there, but sometimes we do. I wanted to just set the record straight. I'm sorry. I don't mean to be disrespectful. But I would like to ask Ms. Krenke a question, if I may.
Ms. Krenke would join us again. Welcome back again. Ms. Berg.
Thank you, Madam.
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Krenke, I was wondering, in terms of the staffing ratios, California and Massachusetts, who do have staffing ratios in law, are able to do it, and CMS still applies to those states, and they are able to implement the staffing ratio law without allowing the chief nursing officer to set the ratios. And so why have other states been able to bypass the chief nursing officer?
Ms. Krenke. Madam Chair and Representative Berg, first of all, let's just to clarify, Massachusetts only has a staffing ratio on their ICU unit. It's not throughout the hospital. It's just in ICU units. California has had a staffing ratio in place for almost 20 years, but it still involves the chief nursing officer making staffing decisions. They just have to staff to a 4-to-1 ratio. So, but the staffing, the chief nursing officer still ultimately decides what staff is where. The obligation has not been moved to a committee, and it's certainly within the hospital. It's not arbitration with a court system. So that's the part that our members are particularly concerned about. So, thank you.
Chair Feist.
Thank you. I just wanted to make a conceptual point. So I talk a lot with the Department of Administration's Office of Collaboration and Dispute Resolution because they oversee the Civility Caucus, which is a bipartisan, bicameral group of legislators who develop positive relationships so that we can effectively govern. So they are my BFFs. And I was talking with them about, like, what are the other options? Like, is there another mechanism we could use as a tiebreaker? And one of the things they mentioned is that there is, like, a concept of a hybrid of arbitration and mediation. And it's basically a scenario where you have, like, the, like, quote-unquote threat of arbitration, you know, the possibility of this neutral tiebreaker mechanism, but you mediate first. And what they've found is that actually that can be very effective in encouraging really good faith negotiations and a really effective mediation. And so I don't think that we should conceive of arbitration as this, like, hammer hanging over the head of these committees and that they're going to just be, like, trying to get to that arbitrator. It actually is a really proven method that is sometimes used to resolve disputes. So it's not exactly what we have here, but I think conceptually it really is what we've done with adding mediation at the request of the hospitals before it would go to arbitration. Just wanted to mention that.
Thank you, Chair. Sure. Senator Abler.
Oh, is mediation added where it wasn't there before?
Yes, Senator right. Abler, mediation has been added to the bill in the course of the negotiations yeah. And the and really the development of the proposal.
Thank you. Let me just, can I take a short survey of the, is it the consensus of the two of you in particular that arbitration needs to be a part of this?
You know, from my perspective, Senator Abler.
Yes or no, but you can certainly explain.
If it's all right.
Well, you're the chair.
Yeah, thank you. I'm just thinking about the 6 hours of debate that has happened on the floor this afternoon for paid family medical leave, which I was not a part of. So I'm going to use just a couple of words here. I do believe that, one, Minnesotans, two, people who choose to work in healthcare are by their nature problem solvers, that there is not a benefit to getting to impasse when you're taking care of patients, and you would recognize that for yourself. Where I've heard nurses share their frustration over and over again is that despite their professional judgment and expertise, their voices are not fully considered, maybe heard but not considered in the staffing plans that are made for hospitals prospectively. And thus, the creation of a staffing committee, the addition of mediation, I think, reflects the nature of people who choose to work in healthcare, whether they're in management, the chief nursing officer, and the direct care staff, right? We need to solve a problem together. It is in our nature to do that. But from my perspective, the tool of arbitration is there in case, just in case. The group that are there in good faith can't reach a conclusion. And it is my, you know, I mean, I've got now a number of years of experience with the parties that are a part of this discussion, whether it is registered nurses through M&A, and our hospitals. The relationships there and the work that has happened has shifted over the last 25 years, no doubt about that. And when I heard one of the testifiers talking about lawyering, I think lawyering has continued to play a more prominent role in the work of hospital administration. And I think business practices are more and more influencing decisions around patient care delivery.
The nurses want to make sure that their critical thinking, their judgment, and their skills are influencing patient care delivery, not only to protect their licenses, but to make sure we're getting the best outcomes. I know registered nurses, and they are going to go to that question first with the hope of influencing the outcome, and if not, going to mediation. I think that arbitration would be a tool rarely used because the chances of it being as successful as the mediation is a consideration. And I think that the act of working together with the others in the hospital is where we're going to get not only the best answer on the question of staffing, but I think, and again, I think a lot about our work here, and putting those parties back at a table together at times that are not just about negotiating a contract could yield additional benefits in terms of cooperative work in making sure that we're taking care of our patients. So there are really two, for me, important outcomes to those staffing committees and mediation, but I think arbitration has to be there or the voice of the nurse is going to be considered but not necessarily weighed in the way that it needs to be. And that is, as some have called it, one more step of power. But I think it is that step of power that keeps everybody in the process of mediation, and that's where we want conflict resolved. That's well, my you. Take.
No, that was a very good answer, and my question is more practical than theoretical. One thing I'm good at is math, Madam Chair, and it seems as though if that's something you're committed to, then I have a feeling those words might be staying in here. So I appreciate that you added the word mediation, and assuming that that word is going to stay in here, is there a way to create kind of a some few words, as Representative Feist commented on, that they have to really truly work at it, and it's not just like you're going to, well, we had two meetings and we're giving up, we're just going to go right to arbitration, but some kind of a threshold they have to, I mean, you can, I mean, again, in an arena where there's distrust, which I sense in this, the bill is here because of harm and, you know, perceived harm and all that, and I'm not even going to, I support the purpose of the bill. But so in an era where there's, you need arbitration, that's not a happy place to be when you're doing the arbitration. You know, people are striking and all that. It's not like a vacation. So, and so if you can help them, like, never use, never break the glass to take that tool out, if there's someplace in between, like, some more words you stick in there that if an impasse after something is declared after they've tried, like, a whole bunch of times or something like that, so that you really have to work at getting to there. Just a thought that might actually help you maintain the lever that you feel you need, and then reassure the people who are concerned about this word that it's, life is going to go on where most things are going to be resolved without even mediation, and then mediation's the big hammer. Is that, I think that might help accomplish what you want and allay concerns that I think are maybe even, well, that are genuine enough. So what do you think of that?
I appreciate the input.
Thank you.
Are there other questions? All right. Senator Abler.
You did say any more questions.
Yeah.
And so I think you're going to want to figure out what to do with the Department of Health, who doesn't know how to do a grading thing, and perhaps going back to my suggestion earlier.
I will say, really, Senator Abler, that in countless meetings, the Department of Health has been present. I was glad to get there. In countless meetings, the Department of Health has been present. It is all good that they are expressing their concerns at this point, but this isn't the first time they've seen the language.
Yeah, and so I...
Yeah.
This is actually my first meeting of any, so for me, it's news anyway. and there are surprises everywhere. But so it may well be that the department could keep kind of a, as opposed to a grade thing, just a scorecard or just a summary of the various elements, and they may be correct, you haven't even thought of all of them. So just a... And then the definition of elective, do you have something that you're working on with that too?
Chair Feist.
Yep, thank you. You know, I wrote down page 23, but I didn't see exactly what was being referred to. There are two places where elective surgery is mentioned, and that was not the page where we added the nuance. So I for sure can come back to that because yeah. It was one of those issues. It's always good to know kind of what issues people care most about. And that was one of those issues that seemed resolvable. And we thought we had, but if looks like we'll have some more opportunity to do a few changes. And so I'm happy to look at that again. I would have to find the other place where it was mentioned because page 23, I believe, was referenced. That's not the place where I think we added the nuance. So anyway, I can follow
Madam
up.
Madam Chair, I'm almost done. I'm not trying to write your bill. I'm just here as
Senator Abler.
Hopefully a productive member with
We've worked together for a long time, Senator Abler.
Anyway, so and this is my last question, and I'm not sure who knows. So we're talking about nurses and staffing ratios. What about other staff at the hospital? Is this going to affect, I mean, all the things that are there? I'm sure you've thought about that. Is this going to have a productive effect, or is it going to
Senator Abler, you know, be really, really clear that the bill does not contain ratios, obviously.
Did I say ratios? I didn't say ratios. Did I?
Yeah, that's okay.
I don't like ratios.
Anyway. Yeah, I know you don't.
Oops.
But when you think about the staffing committee, 35% direct care registered nurses, 15% direct care workers, LPNs, nursing assistants, et cetera. So a more broad perspective on the people who do the patient care work in the hospital. Yes. So they are expressly included. And have been over a number of years working alongside nurses and others, both in our facilities, but in the development of this proposal, and they are invested.
I think you've come a long ways, and I think you're getting close to the finish line.
Thank you, Senator Abler. With that, members, we are going to recess. And we will come back at the call of the chair yet this evening. And with that, members, we're in recess.